troubles, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Jock on Dresser After Dark.
Close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have
Mary Hayes Greco coming up.
Fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes.
Mary Hayes Greco with us. She's the author of Unconditional Forgiveness, a simple and proven method to forgive everyone and everything. She's taught her powerful method of forgiveness in a wide variety of venues since 1990. With her background in psychology and her 10 years of intensive personal training with Dr. Edith Stolfer, PhD, Mary has refined her method of forgiveness as well as the way it's taught in the workshops, making this life-changing process accessible to everyone. This consistently effective program has transformed thousands of lives. Mary Hell, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we look at this word forgiveness. I'm sure it has many different definitions and dimensions along the road. Actually, before we can even get into anything, we have to define it so we're all on the same page with it. So, Mary, let's define.
We really do.
Yeah,
people
what is?
People have a lot of concern about that word, and it's kind of a word that's a problem for a lot of people. And I like the definition that we've been using now for over 20 years because I've never found anyone to argue with me about it. and it really puts you in the driver's seat with being able to do forgiveness. And the forgiveness definition that I use is to say that forgiveness is the refreshing experience of releasing an expectation that is causing you to suffer. That you have some expectations in your mind that are not lining up with how reality is turning out, and every time reality does what it does, you are disappointed or frustrated or angry, etc. And you have the power to release your expectations, and that's what our method helps people to do.
So in essence, what we're saying is if I'm looking for this major opportunity in a profession, and for some reason I can't get it, and then I go find another one and I can't get it, I'm going to come back and blame you because it's your fault, because you did this to me. That's why I can't fully express myself to get these jobs. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, I think people do tend to blame outside circumstances because we don't want to feel disappointed in ourselves. We don't want to feel ashamed. We don't feel like losers. We don't want to have, you know, just bad feelings about ourselves. So we blame the situation. But that blame really shuts us down, and it does not help us the next time we're trying to get a job. So if we're able to really roll with life's disappointments and really express how much we wanted something, how we feel about not getting it, and then to move through that into kind of a greater space inside us, a more accepting and trusting and creative space that's inside us, we let that previous expectation just melt away, just dissolve. And it keeps us open. It keeps us open for luck and opportunity and synchronicity. So we do forgiveness for our own selves so that we're not walking around all glum and burdened and shut down and keeping opportunities away.
There's another area to look at that you discuss, the proper nutrition, the daily exercise, and unconditional forgiveness. But let's go into proper nutrition and daily exercise for a moment. We are an electrochemical factory. You eat the wrong foods, it's going to create havoc within your body and also expand on those negative emotions that are laying there waiting to come out when something you recognize looks like the old stuff. And so I truly believe very strongly if you want mental and emotional health, you better eat right and you better exercise.
I agree. And I guess what we're talking about here is about dealing with toxicity. We don't want to have physical toxicity from eating bad food and being in polluted environments, and we don't want to have emotional toxicity from carrying resentments around for a long time, because those resentments are like poison. And you really feel toxic after a while. If you are carrying a resentment, you feel heavy, you feel negative, you don't really open to the new things that you need to. So the forgiveness exercise we do for our own sake so that we are clearing our body, our mind, our emotions, our energy field, and we are really opening up to the flow of our soulful life into our present day.
Isn't blame and, you know, pointing that proverbial finger at somebody saying it's your fault or a condition is your fault, isn't that a learned response? Isn't that something that people, that we've learned to react to? If something happens, it can't be me, it's got to be you, because if it's me, I'm not living up to what somebody else thinks of me. And when it really comes down to, if it's a learned response, you can unlearn and you can relearn.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think that a lot of us grew up with the modeling from others about being victims and really feeling like, you know, well, you're lucky or you're not, or you got it or you don't, or that sort of thing. And blame and judgment is kind of part of an older, toxic, more toxic paradigm that we are shedding as in these days, that we're really trying to find out more about what humans are really capable of and trying to establish ourselves in the more positive octave, if you will, of the music that people can play.
Sure. Now, when we really deal with what's going on today, bad economy, no question about it, that little bit of assuredness that you might have had 10, 15 years ago of what's going to go on in the next 5 or 10 years seems to have just kind of dwindled away and disappeared. So we've got a lot of people on edge about this.
We do, and I think it's really important how we look at it. I think it's pretty important how we frame things. And I look around, and I if I frame it one way, I feel really scared, and I feel like there's just these wide open empty spaces, and things are just, you know, really going downhill. If I look at it another way, I say, wow, we are in this amazing transformational time where society is just morphing like crazy into its next era, and there's just a lot of fallout from that. There's a lot kind of being created at once, and there's a lot that's dying away at once. It's really a birthing and death time in our human adventure. And I think if you align yourself with the idea that we're really in the process of creating the next big thing for how we're going to be doing our societies, and you align yourself with that excitement and that creativity, then I think you find that you know, the energy is opening things up for you as opposed to putting you in this scared little corner.
There's another area of concern, and I know you talk about it, and it's very important. There's a difference between forgiveness and you say, you know, resignation. And most people, they get to a point where, well, I don't really forgive you, but I've lived with it long enough, it kind of goes flat. But it's still there lying underneath.
Yes, that's true. And I think we can really get ourselves into a vibrant and accurate and positive relationship with just about everyone in our lives. Not that we can hang out with them. I mean, some people we need to forgive and not see them. Some people we need to forgive and say no to them. And some people we need to forgive and not invite them to the holiday dinner because they always get roaring drunk. And we have some boundaries. We just don't want that behavior around us. But the way I've learned about forgiveness is that it really behooves us to always do that forgiveness as a private act of clearing yourself and just getting this old stuff out of your system. And then when you think of these people, you can see some good in them. Like I have a next-door neighbor who, just personality-wise, she's perfectly despicable. She's perfectly odious to my personality. I don't know how we ever ended up living right next door to each other, but I have learned to forgive her completely a while back, and now I just watch her stomping back and forth looking like a little scrunchy, angry troll, and, you know, hearing her terrible, hard, screechy voice, and and I just kind of appreciate her as she's just, you know, she's just a creature in the world like I am. So I think if you can really embrace this notion of unconditional forgiveness, forgive everyone, forgive everything, it doesn't mean that you're going to be a victim or that you're going to be open to abuse. It doesn't mean any of that. It really means that you're just really being open to life and really rolling with it as it comes around and looking for the best.
Let's look at this another way also, and this is the way that I've looked at forgiveness probably 90% of my life. If you take responsibility for your actions and how you feel and how you responded to someone else's actions, there's nothing to forgive them for, because if you take the responsibility, you did it. And that's very powerful in and of itself. And by the way, you're right, there's a tremendous amount of people out there that are quote-unquote, I'm a victim of this, I can't get rid of that, and if it wasn't for you, and if it wasn't for her, and if it wasn't for this, I would be. And that keeps them effectively, that same thing keeps them stuck in those same old, I'm going to call them neutral patterns where you never get anything out of what you're looking for. Realistically, what I'm seeing here is the workshop, what it really does, it allows you to take responsibility for who you are, your own emotions, and your own responses to what happens.
It really does, and that's a very highly conscious point of view that you're expressing, and I really appreciate that you're expressing that. And the other thing is, we can give the other person responsibility for their actions, that we can sort out with kind of a boundary, an energetic boundary. You know, this is your stuff. These are your actions and attitudes and responsibilities. And this is mine, my actions, my attitudes and responsibility. And it's a kind of a relief either way to assume that the person, yeah, maybe they have incurred some consequences or karma, if you want to look at it that way. But sure, we don't need to know what that is. It's kind of like there's kind of a higher thing going on that we don't have to worry about. And that we also on another level, on a highly conscious level, like you were expressing, we have created this. This is our classroom. This is our lesson. This is our experience. Sure. And on some level, it was my idea. So what did I get out of it? And what am I learning?
You know, and one of the things that I learned probably, Mary, probably 25 years ago this happened, that I had a blame thing going on. Somebody said to me something very interesting. My dad died when I was, 8 years old. And I was talking to somebody one day, and I said, well, my dad died. He says, well, now you got rejected. I said, what do you mean I got rejected? He died. And he said, the opposite of acceptance is rejection. And those are the things that we're not consciously aware of. And we can have something like that that can happen, and you've got the rejection going on, but logically, it doesn't look like it happened that way.
That is really, really true, and it's a very deep and sad place, and it's so irrational, you might not even recognize it. But it's interesting, because I worked with a client who had kind of the opposite part of that story, where he lost his six-year-old son in a freak household accident. And this man was in depression and grief and sorrow for 17 years to some degree. And he'd done many grief groups and therapy and all of that. And he just could not get rid of this shadow in his life about this loss of this little boy. And when I worked with him in the workshop, we were really trying to get to the bottom of it. What is the expectation that you need to release in order to find some freedom with this story? And it was just what you're saying, Michael. It was the dad, felt rejected that the little boy had left. And, you know, your mind could say, well, the little boy, he got killed in this thing falling on him. How did he do that? But your heart, your emotions say, oh, you left me. You left me. I wanted to be your dad for years and years. I wanted to go to your wedding. I wanted to have these experiences. And it was so amazing because I gave him permission to, you know, in the forgiveness process, you can really express anger if it's there, even if it makes no sense. And this man, for the first time in 17 years of trying to get over this, he expressed anger at his son for leaving him. And that was what did it. It was the key. It flew open the bars of the cage he was in, and this man, he stood up straight and tall and looked at the horizon for the first time in so many years, and he said, wow, I realize I've been walking around with my head bowed. I'm literally looking across at the horizon now. And it was amazing to see how his posture transformed. And what was really also wonderful was that letting go of that rejection, he then could feel his son's spirit, his son's soul, connecting with him in this very loving, energetic, buoyant way in his heart. And he hadn't been feeling that while he was locked in his cage.
Yeah, there's two things that you came up with. Let's bring them to the table. If you want to fix something, you got to know what it is before you can fix it. And I would venture to guess that most people work on a problem that they don't have, as opposed to the one that they do have. They never get anywhere. So you end up asking the wrong questions, and you get the right answers for the wrong questions. You never get anywhere. But if you can get yourself set with the right questions, then you move. If you want a working definition, a common sense definition of anger, it's blocked expression. And when you really come down to it, who have you ever gotten mad at that you could speak to in a way that they understood what you meant by what you said?
Yes, that's true. I really like what you're saying. The way I think about anger is similar. I see it as anger is a doorway to your power. And that we can't really, in many situations, freely express our anger just the way it is because people can't handle it. They just really get defensive or freak out or run away or whatever. And so in our process, we give ourselves permission to speak our anger very honestly to this empty chair and to, you know, just let it be the way it is. So that's really good. And I forgot the first thing you said, the first thing you started out with.
Now, I was going to go with permission also, which is a very interesting thing. You hit the nail on the head. People need permission, but they don't realize that they can give themselves the permission. You know, I'm mad at this one for that, and I don't like that one for that, and my life is miserable for that, and I don't know what to do. And it's giving yourself permission to be able to leave the old stuff behind and move forward. I think that's really where
that's
the key
right.
is.
And first you give yourself permission to move forward, and then you go into those feelings for a while, just as they are. You give yourself permission to really have the feelings totally honestly. And then when you feel kind of a sense of being done with that, a shift, and then you move to releasing the expectations, and you move through the later stages of the forgiveness. And it's great. And I just thought of what you brought up before, which is kind of a really important notion, which is you said you got to know what it is you're working on. You got to know what the problem really is. And how I've seen that play out is sometimes people are trying to forgive something that's really a big exaggerated response to something in the present moment that you wonder, yeah. Why are they so upset about that? And it's because there's a tap root to it. They think they're mad at their husband, but in fact, this is an issue that was very big with them and their mother, and they didn't really recognize that. And it's got a lot of feelings attached to it, but it's down there in the taproot. And I always encourage people to address your present time forgiveness issue with someone who's right in front of you. But if it's really kind of big and it doesn't quite clear all the way, it's probably because it's got an older root and you're not yet working on the right problem.
No question. Mary, we're just about out of time, but let me leave it with this. I found the answer to all of it. I'm serious. I did. If you came to my place, down in the basement, there's an office, there is a studio, there is also a gym down here. In that gym in that gym is Barney the Beat-Up Bag. That's his name, Barney the Beat-Up Bag. You know those heavy bags boxers hit? Okay. Barney's job is to get hit. He loves to get hit. That's what he was made for. So when I get frustrated and angry and that, I come down and say, Barney, it's time. And he says, come on, Dad, let's do it. And Barney gets beat up. I feel better and I go about my life.
You get Barney. That's right. I have a version of Barney down in my basement office. It's a punching bag and a baseball bat. Yeah, every now and then I got to go down there and just have it out.
And by the way, it's great because what it does, it's constructive. It doesn't hurt anybody. You got your stuff out and you've intentionally done what you need to do. Absolutely. All right, let's finish it with this. Can we get a website where we can find you at, buy the book, and get more information about classes, individual counseling?
Yes, it's easy. It's forgivenesstraining.com.
Forgivenesstraining.com.
Forgivenesstraining.com. And that is a section on my own website, MaryHaysGreco.com. You can plunk in either name and you'll get there.
Wonderful. Mary Hayes Greco, thank you so much.
About six times a year. We've got one coming up here in Minnesota in January, one in February, one in March, one in May. And I'll be visiting other places, Portland, Seattle, February, and Chicago, and Austin, and Boston in the coming time. So you can look for my schedule there.
Don, you know what? Barney just winked at me. He heard me. Mary, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Good night.
Stay there. There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Anne Balaban with us. She is the author of Common Sense is Uncommon, Helping You Live Up to Your Full Potential. She's an adult educator, a motivational speaker, and a trainer. She is an internationally recognized expert in human potential and uses this ability to inform and inspire audiences towards reaching great heights in both their professional and their personal lives. Again, she is the author of Common Sense is Uncommon. Anne, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's nice to hear your voice.
Oh, thank you for being here. And did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Yes, you did.
Oh, good.
It is Balaban.
Balaban. Oh, good. Okay, that gives me one up on it, and I'm a happy guy. Now, by the way, common sense, that's almost a term that's been forgotten as the cultures have moved into whatever they are today. Where do you think we lost it? Because common sense, just quote-unquote, like the book says, isn't uncommon. I would beg to differ just a little bit. It's become uncommon. Well, maybe we said the same thing.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Common sense is uncommon.
Uncommon. Yeah, I should take a pill. But it is uncommon today. People have no idea what it even is.
Which is very true. Things that we expect never happen. Things that should happen doesn't work. And we always look from our own perspective of what's right and wrong, and it just isn't there. We sit around waiting for what should happen, and it never does. And we always say, well, isn't this common sense? And it never happens.
No, and it never does. I love one of the examples that you have. Trying to quit smoking during the most stressful time of the year, which is the holidays, is a recipe for more stress. It's not going to happen.
But yet, that's the number one issue. All the best things during the holidays, we're going to stop smoking, we're going to go on a diet, we're going to join a gym. And those are the three main things that never going to happen, especially not without a good plan or anything else. And you have to laugh at everybody that tries to do it during the holiday season.
No, absolutely. And where do you think this all started from? And I would venture to guess that common sense, the uncommon common sense, has probably been around for a long time. But I go back to, you know, I was brought up in the 50s, junior high school, et cetera. And we lived in a different world. That world in and of itself was not so technical oriented. You didn't have all this information slamming at you. You didn't have news, you know, 27 hours a day. And the televisions, you know, they were live. They were just, you know, time for Beanie, and nothing really made any sense. It was all a joke. But then we got into the world that we live in today, and we just outthink ourselves. We think ourselves into confusion and in sometimes oblivion.
Which is very, very true. One of the workshops that I do is I work with the unemployed, people who have been unemployed for a while, and to get them back on track. And one of the things I ask them to do is actually mail a thank you note after they do an interview. 3/4 of people don't even know what the heck a thank you note is, let alone to write one. And we practice doing that. And yet that common sense of saying thank you and being polite is the thing that gets them the job. It is absolutely unbelievable that the thing that you and I grew up with, the common sense that we know, is coming back.
Yeah.
And that's the easiest thing to do. The word thank you, many of the seniors who are in my class, they send money to their young grandchildren, and all they want is a thank you note, which is really fun because it's the last thing
the kids will do today. The story that I like to give, I have two sons who are now adults. I used to make them write thank you notes for any gift anybody ever gave them. And one day, and they would never lie to me, please understand. And one day they opened up a gift and I said, did you write the thank you note? And they said, yes, we did. And I said, but the people didn't get it. They said, well, we wrote it. We went on computer and we wrote the thank you note. It's not our fault that they don't have computers. The world has changed.
The world has changed. No, absolutely, the world has changed. And I would think that common sense is realizing one thing and one thing only. Ask me what my favorite subject is. Go ahead, ask me what my favorite subject is.
What is your favorite subject?
Me. See,
what is it?
Dad, if you want someone's attention, when I say me, I'm talking about all of us. And if you want someone's attention, use common sense and direct the attention to them if you want something. Or if you're saying thank you, that's also acknowledging that the person exists, so you're still talking about them. Very important. People are geared this way. If it's all about them, and it's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But when you begin to know it, then you can use common sense. You can think. You don't have to think the way you think and be rejected and disappointed because you're not reaching out and touching someone. It's called stepping outside of yourself and thinking the way they think, and that is common sense.
Definitely. And, you know, in my book, I wrote, there are 50 motivational sayings in my book. I had over 5,000 brought to me by all my students of all ages, from 16 years old to 103, by the way.
Wow.
And these are the ones that made the most impact. And one of them says, people remember how they were valued by you, how it made them feel by being with you. They don't remember what you tell them to do. They don't remember anything else. It's just how you value them. And that's simply done, common sense, by listening, by absolutely listening to somebody else has to say. That they value.
Maya Angelou, the poet, said that people
yes.
won't remember what you said or what you did, but they will remember how you made them feel.
Exactly. And she also said something that I love. If you can't change something, change the way you look at it. And that's
yeah.
the basis of what I wrote.
Yeah.
Change
and
your thought process.
No, and I'm sorry. Go ahead. We're just a little bit of a delay, so every once in a while we stumble on each other. Go ahead and finish the thought. I'm sorry.
No, I was saying if you can't change something, change the way you look at it.
Yeah.
And that's the key to the book that I've written. If something isn't working for you and you can change it, I'm talking about in-laws and outlaws and daughter-in-laws and son-in-laws and everything else. If it's not working for you, then change the way you look at them. Look at something good, something you have in common with those people, and make a connection. At any age, at any time, there's a connection to be made.
Sure. And by the way, when you come down to it, there's that old adage about think outside the box. Most people, you know, they really don't have a definition or handle on what that means. See, we all think pretty much the same thoughts. You mix them up and they're going to come out a little different, but for the most part, the same. Thinking outside the box is thinking thoughts you didn't think you could think. And what that is stepping outside of yourself and thinking like the person that you're trying to communicate with. That in and of itself is one of the most valuable gifts you can give to someone.
Couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
That's exactly
absolutely.
What I teach.
Now, by the way,
we're on the same wavelength here.
Thank goodness. Okay, now let me ask you this. The subject matter itself, common sense, what was it that triggered you? What was it that made you sit back and say, my goodness, there's more to this than meets the eye?
You know, it's interesting you should ask me that. The name of the book I've had for over 20 years. It was the book itself that I had to put together. Every class, every workshop, every motivational speech I've ever given, there was always a comment. It doesn't matter when, where, how, why. Don't people know this is common sense? Why don't they act like this? Why do they do? Isn't this common sense? And yet, in every single issue, it wasn't. Shouldn't everybody open the door for each other? Shouldn't anybody say thank you? Should. And the answer is no, it isn't common sense. For some reason, common sense died a long time ago.
No, I'll tell you a great story.
And it was really...
Tell you a great story. This happened probably... 3-4 years ago, Susie Greenman, Radio Susie, and I had an appointment downtown in Milwaukee. So we parked the car, we walked across the street, and we went into one of the major buildings. Now, we're standing on the outside of the building, And I opened the door. Susie walked in, and there was a young woman, middle 30s, on the outside, on the inside of the door. And she stood there and looked at me, and I kept the door open for her. She walked out, and she stopped. She almost had tears in her eyes. I'll never forget the way she looked. And she said, "People just don't do that anymore." Yeah.
Very, you know, very, so, very true.
Yeah.
That's very, very true. The thing is, it's really funny because you can be very sarcastic and say, "You're welcome," before they say thank you. And they look at you like, "What was that? What, yeah. what? It was very interesting to get people's attention by not having the common sense.
Yeah, and you know what? It's always good to go out of your way. Do this when I go to the market. If there's somebody that they've gone to their car, they're unloading their stuff, and maybe they're an older person. Don't look at me that way, Radio Susie. An older person. I get a hold of their basket, and I'll take it in for them. If somebody's reaching up high on a shelf, if you can do it, just do it. Those are the things that somehow we've lost. And the only way to gain them is for somebody to start doing it and somebody else will start doing it. And that's really how this is created.
Well, can I give you an example that we do?
Please.
We have something in Canada called Tim Hortons. I think it's coming down to the U.S. And the deal is that it's a drive-through coffee. And once in a while, the idea is that you pay for the person behind you and don't tell them. So what I did is I do this quite often. I will, believe me, it's under $2. It's a coffee. So every time I pay for someone behind me, I stop the car just to watch what they do. And it is fascinating how people are so surprised that they have no idea. Why would somebody ever pay $2 for their coffee? And they always look around. Who is the person and what do they want? So it's rethinking that completely. And the other example I could give you, I was in a line and I had to give a speech. And the person in front of me was short some money. And he had a coffee and a bagel or something. And I was behind him. And just to rush him, I said, here's $2 for your coffee. And he looks up at me and he said, "And how about my bagel?"
No, that's funny. You know what? I like
it. It was to me. I just looked at him and I go, "Excuse me." The idea of common sense, you have to have some laughter in there. And that's the biggest thing in the holiday season. Look, the idea is the stress is there and you got to laugh at everything that you do because this isn't the time to take anything seriously. This is the time to have fun, be playful, meet people, do all kinds of things. And then
Absolutely. Do
the serious changes later on.
No question about it. Let me ask you this. Anne, do you have a website we can find you at?
Of course. It's annebalaban.wordpress.com.
Anne Balaban, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Absolute pleasure.
Take care. And by the way, thank you for being here. Good night.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore, for now and evermore. That's all, that's all.
Welcome back on Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Troy Timmons with us. He's the author of Mommy, Please Read This, The Facts About Child Sex Abuse. It's The Facts About Child Sex Abuse. He is a licensed sex offender treatment provider in private practice in Amarillo, Texas. He teaches at seminars on child abuse across the United States and provides expert testimony in child sexual abuse cases. Having treated hundreds of both survivors and predators of sexual abuse, he brings unique insight to the issue of preventing and responding appropriately to the American silent, and it's a silent epidemic, child sexual abuse. And his book, Mommy, Please Read This, The Facts About Child Sex Abuse, and I want to say that three or four times during the interview, is receiving generous praise for its heartwarming expose of the heartbreaking subject of sexual abuse. And let us say, Troy, how welcome to the show.
Oh, wow. Thanks so much, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Troy, let me ask you this question. Obviously, we know what just went on at Penn State. But it was going on for a long time, and it was quiet. What is the silent message? This is, well, it's not silent anymore, but what's the message that this is sending to the population here? And I don't mean just people who have been abused or parents or relatives of, but the population in general. What should we learn out of this?
Yeah, great question. You know, I think that there's a lot of things we need to learn, and you know, from the Penn State Sandusky case and even the Syracuse case. You know, these are high-profile cases, but the reality is similar circumstances are going on in cities around our country. You know, one of the things that we can learn from this is, you know, particularly the Penn State situation is that, you know, it's not about the institution, it's not about reputations, it's not about careers or famous people, this is about children. And so I think the good thing that's coming from these tragic events is, you know, we're talking about it. We're talking about the realities of child sexual abuse and the fact that this is oh, I'm sorry, we're getting a little feedback there, but it's not about strangers. It's more about friends and family and people that we trust. And I think that's these cases really bring that, you know, to the forefront.
Troy, I think the first message. Well, let me just a second. Hey, Seth, we're echoing. Can you nail us here? Thank you. That's the magic person on the board, the engineer who does all the good things for this network.
All right.
Let me go to this just for a moment. I think the first message that we found out from Penn State was this: money rules all. You're looking at tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that could have been stopped because of the expose and what would have happened. Then it finally got beyond that. But in the very beginning, they went back to it. They took a look at, you know, why was it that it wasn't brought to the fore? Why wasn't that it wasn't publicly addressed at the time and people arrested and so on and so forth? The amount of money that could have gotten lost. And that's a very interesting point that we have to look at. And, you know, who suffers? The kids?
Yeah, absolutely. The kids, their families, you know, their children, everybody that's, you know, in that circle. You know, I think it is you make a good point. There's a sad commentary there, you know. In so many ways, we care more about our stuff, i.e. money, you know, than these relationships and these children. And I think that the Penn State situation just really points out that certainly it appears that there were some folks that were, you know, obviously misguided. I think the other thing, though, that we can learn from, you know, the Penn State and other cases like that is that, you know, our reality is that there are people that we know and we love and we care and we trust and we look up to. And unfortunately, some of those folks, you know, are behaving in ways that are very inappropriate. And that's hard for people, I think, to kind of understand typically because, you know, we don't want to think that friends of ours and family members and these people that we look up to, you know, are capable of doing this because then it's a bit of a commentary on us. And so I think that's one of the things that keeps us as a society from really engaging in this conversation. When you look at the numbers, we need to be talking about this, you know. Fully one out of four girls are sexually abused before they're 18, and they estimate probably one out of six boys. So given those numbers, you know, it's something that we should definitely be discussing. It's just very difficult for, it seems to me, communities to do that.
Well, sure. You know, the word in bringing you in was called, you know, the silent problem we have. Well, you know, it's not so silent anymore. And I really believe it started to come out when with the Catholic Church and the scandals that were going on there. and it's run, sure. it's running rampant. And it's not just the Catholic Church. I'm sure there's other churches that the same thing happens in schools and so on and so forth. So when we're talking about child abuse, sexuality has become so rampant. Now, I'm not a moralist. I'm not. I never have been. I'm a pragmatist. And I think there's a difference between the two. You know, these kids at 8, 9, 10 years old can get a hold, earlier than that, they can get a hold of these, you know, the X-rated stuff you can get on, you know, for the games and what they can watch on television. There isn't anything that they don't know now. And, you know, 12, 13, 14-year-old girls wanting the morning after pill because they're going to get pregnant at that age. So this has really got to start at home. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, and that's not just getting so so hard on everything that nobody can do anything, but we've got to get somehow rein this stuff in and get it to where it's workable and manageable. It is not manageable anymore, because when we talk about child abuse, look at all the offshoots we have that's going on in the schools and everywhere else.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and the fact that, you know, the start at home, you know, that really should be our core message, you know, sort of the mantra. You know, these cases, contrary to, you know, what has been popular belief now for decades, rarely involve strangers. I mean, it's almost always a family member or a friend of the family, somebody that has an ongoing relationship with not just the child, but the parents of the child. So the starting at home is really critical. And, you know, in interviewing hundreds of sex offenders, you know, child molesters who have admitted that this is what they did, you know, basically went into the project asking them, you know, how do you target a particular child? How do you, you know, what exactly are the ingredients here? And it was interesting because they, you know, in separate interviews all kind of came back with the same thing, and it was three things. It was, you know, one, I spend time with this kid, and I make it about them, and I listen to them intensely, and I'm the guy that you can tell anything. And then third, they pick the least assertive child. So the offenders are hedging their bets a little bit, hoping that they pick the kid who's least likely to tell. I think that's important information because, obviously, you know, those first two, time and attention, are exactly what you're talking about, and that's it starts at home. I think sure. The other point you point out is, you know, we live in a fairly toxic society when it comes to sex. There's certainly no shortage of yeah. sexualized material in anything, and I think that I think you're right. I think we're starting to see some of the effect, maybe the tipping point of, you know, what we've allowed.
No, absolutely. There's no question about it. And one of the other things that, you know, and some of the kids need to be taught, if you think it's going to happen, say something before it happens, because a lot of these kids, unless they're forced, can get out of it. I don't think they know how to get out of it. I think that's what the problem is. So it's the ability to say, yeah, is to go say no, and if it goes any farther, I'm going to tell my mom. I mean, you know, that could stop a lot of it, or my dad.
Absolutely. And I think the precursor to that situation is, you know, we're not talking about it. It's an issue that, if we're talking about it, it's usually in response to a crisis or to a lead story. And then it's marginal information at best. I think we have to change the whole model, the paradigm. The reality is we're terrible at picking who the bad guy is. You know, we can't do it. Science can't do it. Psychology can't do it. Criminal justice can't do it. So we've got to do what we can, and that's to train children to be less of a target. And so my idea is assertiveness. You know, offenders have overwhelmingly said if the child's the least bit assertive, they're less likely to take on that kid. That's good news for us as parents and caregivers, because we can train that. We can teach that. And then, of course, the time and attention, you know. When I interviewed offenders time and time again, they would say things like, I find common ground with the kid, find an activity that gets them to relax and open up. I'm the guy that you can tell anything. And I'll never forget, Michael, one guy said to me, look, parents need to know, if you don't want to spend time with your kid, I will. And that should just send chills down all of us right there.
That's scary. Yeah, no, absolutely. And he's right. And because when you come down to it, let me tell you what I'm hearing, and stop me if I'm wrong, because I'm not a clinician, I'm not an expert in this particular field. But at the same time, it almost sounds like they get so close to that kid that anything that they do with the kid to the kid, it's okay. So they're not forcing the kid to do it. Yeah, and that's where the problem is. And I think the fix with that, and you just said it, is let the parents accept the kid. Let home be the place to run to. And when you've got a problem, let them know that mom and dad's got their back. And if there's a problem, you come home and talk.
Absolutely. And then, you know, you think about, you know, we're so busy and we're overwhelmed with information and we're going in 1,000 directions. And I know I'm guilty of this, you know, working on a piece or a presentation or something. And you know, one of my children, you know, speaking to me and I'm doing 2 or 3 things at one time. And I think that what offenders have taught us is that, boy, they are more than willing to come in and exploit those circumstances. And I think that, you know, one of the key messages I hope people will take from all of these discussions that are going on all across our nation, and in part because of these cases, is, you know, we cannot give our responsibility to those children over to other people. You know, if we're not listening to them, we're not spending time with them, unfortunately, you know, these offenders are. I think the other point I'd like to make is, you know, when you look at who offenders are, it is not the strangers. You know, my office manager said earlier today, what you're trying to say is the boogeyman doesn't wear a trench coat.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, that's what we're saying. The boogeyman is probably somebody you're going to invite to the barbecue. In fact, and we've got to get our head around that because our kids deserve better than don't talk to strangers.
Now, you know what we should do? We should have T-shirts. I wrote this down as you were talking, and the T-shirt should say, who do you want to be your mom and dad?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent, yeah.
Yeah, because when it really
I'll
comes
buy it.
Down, yeah, me too. Because that's it, because when it really comes down to it, everything that I've heard you say so far, Troy, is these offenders take the place of mom or dad.
Yeah, and it's a whole process of grooming. And I think, you know, some of the myths about stranger danger, for example, well, statistically, nationwide, less than 10% of these child sex abuse cases are committed by strangers. You know, some studies put it even at less than 7%. So, you know, truly the risk to a child of being sexually abused comes from someone within that child's circle of trust. And I think, again, it's uncomfortable for people to think about that because we tend to think of our friends, the people that we trust and confide in, as very similar to us.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's the old looking glass self. If you're my buddy and you've done something horrible, what does that say about me?
Yeah,
the problem is,
go ahead.
We can't ignore this. I mean, we just can't. You know, fully, 25% of our children, girls, are being abused every, you know, in 18 years. I mean, that's a national crisis that deserves attention.
Again, when you really come down to it, I think really I listen. You know, I just looked at Radio Susie and I said, did you know that as regards to, you know, they take the place of mom and dad? And she looked at me and she said, but thought about that. We have the magic here. I can switch the mic off. You'll never know. But when it comes down to it, that should be part of the message because I never thought about it that way. And that's realistically what it is. Don't let somebody come in and replace your mom or dad and make them think about that.
Yeah, I think that's central, you know, to prevention. I think we've become such a responsive, you know, society. We tend to respond to crisis. And on this issue, all of our responses have done little to, you know, to curb the frequency and the incidence of abuse. It's insufficient to only deal with the people that we're catching. You know, when you look at the fact that most victims and survivors of child abuse, sexual abuse, never tell anybody, then we're really only dealing with a very small number of the offenses that are perpetrated, you know, that are actually reported. So, you know, for me, I think just public education, awareness, help people understand. Almost everywhere I speak, somebody says, so it's really not the strangers. Wow. It's really not. And after, you know, several years of all kinds of people saying that, it still doesn't resonate, it seems to me, with the general public just yet. I think that's one of the things that we're you know, we're trying to do is just get the information out there in a way that's approachable and that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm writing here. Okay, and I really believe there should be another logo. It should be another T-shirt. We're going to become entrepreneurs. We're going to make a billion in T-shirts. don't to the parents, mom, dad, don't let the offenders take your place.
Yeah, exactly, mom, dad, don't do that. I've got a little slogan that we were talking about today, because there's a play on words, stranger danger, and we came up with this one. Where was it? The danger is stranger than you think.
Yeah.
I thought that was brilliant when we were kicking that around, because it's not what you think. And sometimes I'll say, man, it'd just be easier if everybody, all these child monsters would wear trench coats. But the reality is they don't. They look like us. They feel like us. They're like us in every conceivable way, except for this inappropriate, deviant, aberrant sexual behavior. For me, I guess the bottom line, Michael, is this. People need to know that this is preventable. It's not going to happen through law enforcement. It's going to happen when parents and caregivers and responsible adults in communities step up and say, enough. We're not gonna let other people come in and replace us in this role. So I think you're really onto something.
Yeah, realistically, I mean, when you really come down to it, I think the entire, except for what you're doing, Troy, I think the entire issue of child molestation has been approached wrong. And I mean it dead wrong.
Yeah.
And they're not looking at it in the correct way. And I think if you can get them just to make that quick little turn of who it is, why it is, and whose fault is it? It's not the predator. The predator has obviously got responsibility there, but it's mom and dad's fault for not being where they're supposed to be in the position with that child where that child can trust them.
Yeah, or at least sharing some culpability there and not facilitating, those skills that are necessary. We really are talking about the majority of these cases. We're not talking about force or even threats of force. We're talking about child molestation that occurs at the end of extensive grooming and extensive relationship building. Oftentimes the victim is very fond of their offender, and it's because that offender has spent countless hours of time and attention on that child. And that's confusing too. Sometimes people ask, why don't people tell? What took so long? Well, you know what? These offenders are incredibly skillful at developing that relationship and getting the child to buy into the secret. And so their manipulation is at a level that I think most people can't comprehend.
Troy, I got you loud and clear. Your website, so we know where to find you and everything you're doing.
Yeah, thank you. It's Troy Timmons, TIMMONS.com. And that book is available there and also on Amazon.
Wonderful. And the book is Mommy, Please Read This. Hey, Troy, thank you so much. Go out and, as my grandmother would always say, go kick some posterior. I think you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Good night.
You're gonna miss good night.
Hugging you, miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby. When I'm gone away, you're gonna feel lonely and want me only. Cause you know, honey, always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in Rome, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a wanna eat, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me.
me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always have your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Way. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Jim Camp with us, the leading negotiating coach and author of, listen to it, No, the only negotiating strategy needed for work or at home. He's the president and CEO of Camp Negotiation Systems. He's coached individuals, corporations, governments worldwide through hundreds of successful negotiations. And let us say, Jim, welcome to the show.
Michael, nice to be with you.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. What a great way to start something. No. I mean, where can you go with that?
That's when it all starts, Michael.
Absolutely. Too many people are so aggressive. They want to get something done. And, Jim, from what I've seen in the past, they've lost 70% of what they could have gotten if they would have just said no and let the other person come back at them.
That's exactly right. All they got to do is allow discovery.
Yeah. Now, by the way, when was it for you realized, I'm going to say, the power of no?
I got to tell you, Michael, it was 1973, and I was selling water softeners in Santa Barbara, California. I'd just gotten off active duty in the Air Force, and I did everything they told me to do. I closed, didn't sell anything for the first 3 weeks. Got so frustrated, I went back to everybody I called upon and said, look, I just don't want to keep coming back, so just tell me no, you don't want a water softener, and I won't bother you anymore. And lo and behold, I sold 16 water softeners that next week.
Did you do what? Did you uncover the hidden objection that was there before, but you didn't know how to get to?
No, it wasn't a matter of objections. It was me getting out of the way. I was willing to let people off the hook. I didn't want them to have to make a decision. They'd start to get uncomfortable, and I'd say, well, why don't I come back another day? I was just being stupid. So just tell me no and let me go. You don't want a water softener. If I can ever help you, you know, in the future, give me a call.
It was a great idea. Now, by the way, when this started...
Your teeth kicked in, right?
Yeah. Now, by the way, when this started, when you really got the idea behind it, where did it go to? Where did it lead you? How did it change your own personal life?
It took all the pressure off, Michael. It really took the pressure off. And I started making discovery after discovery. That's how I built my system. And you know, in this day and age of neuroscience, I've been studying neuroscience now for the last 2 years with the people who have built my institute and my courses. And what I'm learning is that what I was doing and what our system's done that worked is perfect neuroscience. We know people make decisions emotionally 100%, but the world doesn't know that. So we hammer on details, we hammer on information, we overload information, and we don't even realize that vision is the driving force in decision.
Okay, so
instead of creating vision, we're proving our case.
Okay, so realistically, if you pressure someone, and when I say pressure, you're looking to close something, quote unquote. And to them, it's pressure, even if you're not giving pressure. You set up an entire chemical reaction in the body that causes that person to resist. Even if they wanted it, they're going to say no because they're protecting themselves. It's a shot of adrenaline, and all of a sudden, there's nothing you can do to get beyond that. Unless you frame it in such a way, instead of the adrenaline, they get a little shot of dopamine to feel good stuff. They realize that this is what they want, that can fix something for them, and all of a sudden they feel good about what you offered, and they bought two of them.
Well, you're actually laying it out. You're exactly right. The beauty of it is, Michael, before you enter into what I call spilling your beans and giving up your vital information in the negotiation, if you start the negotiation with, look, I'm going to lay a lot of information out here. It's really okay if you don't agree with it.
I want you to be comfortable. Just tell me no, you don't agree with it. I'll do everything I can to help you see it, but I don't want you to feel any pressure on what I'm laying out here for you. And yeah. You just watch the barriers come down. You watch people's body language change. Suddenly it's a discussion, an open discussion, seeking vision rather than, you know, defending your turf.
Let me tell you what I think is powerful about that is because you, I, anybody can't determine what pressure means to that person that you're dealing with. And then when you do it that way, it takes the pressure off. You can smile at them, and for them, it's pressure. You're trying to get me to do something. So there is no way that anybody can tell the degree of pressure that somebody has until you start talking to them. But this way, you eliminate the problem before it happens. You address the skepticism before it addresses you.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right.
Okay, so
we don't
now
have any idea what they're under, and they may be working very hard to not show anything. But when we give them permission to say no, it's like, and I've literally seen it in very large dealings. I mean, we're coaching $12 billion this month worldwide, and we do this every day, and we see people relax, sit back in their chair. And it's an amazing event.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. You know, and one of the things that we have to take a look at today, I know one of the things you do talk about is, you know, don't sell, make the presentation. There was a time where you would have to sell an audience, quote unquote. We live in a different time. We live in a different culture. We live in a different technological society. If I want anything, all I have to do is hit Google. I can sit here at my desk, buy a car, shop the market, negotiate, and just go down there and pick it up because it's mine. And I can also check what it's been through in the last couple of years if it's not brand new. So you can't sell anybody anything anymore. So you have to frame it in such a way that they buy it. There is a difference between the two.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's all about, you know, like you said, you can go on Google and you can look at, notice the term look at, what you want, and then you can actually negotiate that item right there on the internet. You don't even know who you're negotiating with.
Yeah, it's called transparency anymore. There's nothing you can't find out, nothing you can't get, no way you can't shop the market for the absolute best price, quote unquote, that there is. So what it boils down to is one thing and one thing only. You have got to have the compelling reason to buy. And it has nothing to do with money, and it has nothing to do with it. It's got to do with what it is that they're looking for that's going to fix a problem, and that very rapid aha moment when they recognize they can fix what they want and what they've got with what you have to offer.
That's exactly right. The one thing I'd add to that, Michael, is really, truly great negotiators help people discover problems they don't even realize they have. You know that old saying, "We don't know. You don't know what you don't know."
Yeah.
One of the real keys is being able to create that vision of the problem that they really don't even realize they have. It's shocking how many people come to us for coaching, and the first thing they want to do is cut their price. But they're not going to like me if I don't give them a good discount to start. They're not even going to let me in the door. Whoa, wait, what are you offering? They spend no time on creating vision of what they're bringing to the table, all the time on trying to influence with compromise.
Sure.
And it's absolutely a waste of time and money. It's hurt this country dramatically over the years.
And Jim,
you know, all of our technology, all of our intellectual property going overseas, are giving it away.
Yeah, and by the way, the word vision is very interesting because a vision is as simple as an example, a story, a metaphor, something of how someone benefited by using what you had to offer. And that's when they find that blind spot, that whatever it was they didn't know that was there to fix what the problem was. And that's when that happens, what you just said. When they find out, it's not what they didn't know, it's what they didn't know they didn't know. And that's, I think, key. And that'll come up with, quote unquote, your vision, if the vision is put together properly and presented properly.
That's exactly right. You've absolutely laid it out. And what's amazing to me, Michael, I see it so often, is people, it, they spend zero time on creating vision, and almost all their time arguing or piling on information, and then they're frustrated that the other person is stupid.
Yeah.
I've had people say, that guy's just stupid, he can't make a decision. And I say, well, tell me what you said to him. Oh, my gosh. It's unbelievable what goes on.
Yeah, but then you have to ask, rhetorically, then you have to ask, did they know what I meant by what I said? If I say to you, chamber around, do you know what that means?
Michael, say that again, I'm sorry.
Well, if I say to you, chamber around, do you know what that means?
No.
Oh, you don't have any vision for it, you don't have an image for it, do you? No, okay.
I have no picture.
Nothing. Okay, but what if I said, put a bullet in the gun? Now you see the bullet and you see the gun.
Oh, absolutely.
There you go. See, a bullet is around in the chambers where you stick the bullet. But the point is, it's got to be done in such a way that they have an image for the words that you're saying. So
that's
you're
right.
On the same
that's page. Exactly right. That's exactly right. I ask people, Michael, I say, what system do you have that keeps you safe and when you make agreements? And you can see the eyes glaze over if you're looking at them. I said, well, what do you mean? Well, what's the first step? What's the first step? What's the first thing you think of? And they're at a loss.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they start to discover, then you'll hear things like, is there such a thing? Can that be done? And it's an amazing discovery process.
You know, when you really come down to it, you know, it's words and what we're talking about, images. I'll give you a prime example. Let's say you're going to give a presentation, a dissertation on the word gun. And your definition of a gun, let's say it's a tool. So you walk into the room, everybody speaks English, you're all on the same page. You say one word, you say the word gun, you walk out of the room. In the room is a cop, there's a hunter, there's a soccer mom. Cop here's tool, this is your guy, you're in context. You got a shared definition, it's part of his or her equipment. The hunter here's toy, here's sport. Soccer mom here's weapon of mass destruction, she's a child killer. So the message here is this, with one word, you gave three distinctly different messages and lost two-thirds of the audience. So in essence, you know, you've got to relay your message to an audience, one person or 10,000, it's the same thing. But they have to be able to know what you meant by what you said. Because entertaining talk is wonderful, even if you're in a presentation or a sale. But if you haven't accomplished what you want going in or on the way out, you wasted your time.
Well, that's exactly correct. That's exactly right. You know, when you said gun to me, I had the image of a 57-millimeter anti-tank gun that I just saw fired yesterday on TV.
I love it.
It flies right in front of me because I just saw it yesterday.
Yeah.
So you're right. Everybody has a different image.
Yeah, but what you got to do is create it in the same frame of reference. A prime example, if I say car, what kind of a car do you see in your mind?
My Aston Martin.
Okay, now, for me, and I don't know why, for the last month or so when I've used this example, what comes up for me is the very first car that I ever owned, which was a 1950 Studebaker. It was blue and had a bullet point front. Okay, that said, the message here is this. With one word, you and I saw two distinctly different images. And I think
anybody's in
presentation, in a cell, whatever the case may be, is making sure when you say something, everybody sees the same image. And it's tied to what you said before, quote, unquote, the vision. The vision can be an example, a story, an acronym, something that somebody can see themselves within it. And I really believe communication, all the years that I've been dealing with it, it's got to have a sense of human presence. It's got to have someone using the information and how they were successful and they fixed the problem by putting to use what you had to offer.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, or something. I'm fighting with a cat. So and the cat's winning and it's speaking its language. It's saying, if you don't feed me, I'm going to bite you. That I understand. All right, let me ask you this. We're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
CampNegotiationInstitute.com.
Okay, and can we get the book there? We can find out for private consultations.
You find out all about the mastery courses that we've built that are perfect neuroscience. You can find out about our credentialed courses that we actually, you see our board of directors that certify the graduate that they're credentialed team member, negotiator. All of that's there at campnegotiationinstitute.com.
Good. Okay, by the way, neurosciences, every time you recognize something that got said, one of those mirror neurons fired up. Okay.
That's right.
Camp. Okay. Hey, take care. Yeah, thank you so much for being on the show. Good night.
You take care of yourself, Mark.
Dancing on my living room rug. Flip-flop, they were doing the bop. All the tunes had the dancing bug. There was Lollipop with a Peggy Sue. Good and golly, Miss Molly was even there too. Well, a splish splash, forgot about the bath. I went and put my dancing shoes on. I was a splishing and a splashing. I was a rolling and a strolling. Yeah, I was a man.
Troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Simon Reynolds with us, the author of Why People Fail, The 16 Obstacles to Success, and How You Can Overcome Them. Simon's a mentor to business leaders worldwide. He's won numerous business awards and co-founded the 15th largest marketing service company in the world with operations in 14 countries. He travels the world speaking on personal and business achievement and coaches a select group of executives and business owners. Let us say, Simon, hi, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, I have the book in my hand, by the way, and it's an absolute keeper. Why People Fail. Simon, do they really know what failure is?
Well, that's a very good question. I think they define it for themselves, and unfortunately, so many people do believe they're failures, and they're often only looking at one area of their life. So let's say they aren't doing well in business, they call themselves a failure. But they may have an excellent home life. They may have a great spiritual life. They may have a great group of friends. So in many ways, they could be a success in many areas of their life. But they themselves focus on just one and turn themselves a failure.
And when we look at business, and you mentioned it, and let me say it in a different way, we talk about business, you talk about your spiritual life, your business life. Really, it's all the same thing. If you're lacking in one, it's going to project into the other two or any of the areas that you have in your life. And I really believe that most people, when they go into business, it's not that they're not smart enough. They don't have the tools to forecast, to be able to see what's ahead of them, to anticipate what possibilities come up and be able to deal with them before they actually happen.
Oh, I think that's absolutely correct. You know, some of the most intelligent people on the planet have failed in business for exactly that reason, that they get caught up doing the day-to-day urgent stuff rather than planning and being strategic and, in fact, learning the handful of high-leverage activities that can really build their business.
Now, by the way, one of the things that I have seen over the years, and I've been around for a couple of years here, that, you know, marketing has changed drastically based on culture. We have a new generation of consumers, and let's call it the net generation. And that's the first generation to grow up with digital technology. And globally, there's about 2 billion people. And there are people who, quote unquote, do not know how to market to this new generation. And they lose out a great amount of success that they could have had if they would have realized how to deal with it.
Well, that's certainly the case. And they continue to use media in a very simplistic way. You know, 20 years ago, they did a newspaper ad, so they do another newspaper ad. Now, there's nothing wrong with newspaper ads or TV ads. They all media work. But, of course, as you say, they have to integrate that with the social media. They have to integrate it with targeted online marketing. And then they'll get a synergistic effect that's much greater than just doing the simple media of previous decades.
And the other thing that I have found is extremely important in marketing today is that word, the C word, collaboration. There are so many people today that do business the old way, and it doesn't work that way anymore, especially with these new kids coming up to the forefront. It has to do with the employees participating. When I say participating, not necessarily in a profit mode, but that they're invested in the companies and they are dealing with a quote unquote, a we generation, a collaborative generation, that when you walk into a company, it's not just employees, they're all part of it, moving in the same direction, trying to get ahead.
Well, that's right, because we've reached a point that in many industries, amongst the talented people, there's all number of companies that would love to employ them. So, you know, a century ago, you were lucky to get a job and hopefully you worked in a factory and didn't get fired. Now, the boot's on the other foot. You've got highly intelligent, highly in-demand people. And if you don't make them part of your community, if you don't collaborate with them and make them feel as if you're a company that's worth giving not just their time to, but their heart to, then there's plenty of other places they can go to work.
Now, by the way, one of your talking points, and I think it's brilliant, it's about enhancing your relationships and subsequently yourself by identifying inner and outer circles of influence. Years ago, they had that, you know, 6 degrees of separation. So if you connected with somebody on the outside, you had maybe 8, 10, 15, 20 people that you could reach for influence. Now, today, it's totally and completely unlimited. I think the people that have the steps, the tools, the techniques to get to success in business realize that their opportunities are unlimited and the resources are as close to sitting at your desk and hitting a button.
Yes, and I have to say it's greatly underestimated, this whole super connection possibility. You know, where we have so many people who are prepared to work 12 hours a day and put their heart and soul into their work, but if only they sat down and worked out, okay, who do I know who knows somebody who can help me, and do that in a regular way, that's an easy way to be successful in comparison to just trying to outwork everybody. And in the book, Why People Fail, I have an entire chapter about the importance of cultivating relationships, also not just in business life, but in personal life as well. All the research shows that the number one determinant of someone's happiness is definitely not money. It's the quality of their relationships.
No question about it. And I really believe when it gets down to it, I think it was Jeff Howe at Wired Magazine, Mark Robinson, who was tied up with him, they call the social networking crowdsourcing. And I guess it became the term of choice that created that online community. It's actually infiltrated every aspect of business today, and I think it's extremely important. There's nobody who's going to be independent anymore, and if you think you are, you're not, and you lose out on so much. It's getting into profitability in this highly competitive marketplace, and there's a way to do it because there is still a tremendous amount of money out there. I don't care what anybody says. You look at a 8 to 10% unemployment rate here in the U.S. They don't talk about the 90 some odd percent of the people that are employed. It's here. Yeah. We just have to have the way to tap into it and that comfortable way that a business can say, yes, this will work.
Yeah, and what I love about this environment at the moment from a business perspective is it's volatile. And inside these volatile environments are a lot of shifting sands that create enhanced opportunity. And unfortunately, you know, oftentimes because the media can be negative and people getting together at dinner can start thinking of the downside, they forget, as you say, the enormous upside of this fast rate of change is throwing out opportunity after opportunity for new business models, for new product cycles, for new ways of thinking that, you know, can make people a very large amount of money in the next 5 years.
Well, absolutely. And the individual today, because of the technology, let's, you know, trace a little bit of history of the United States. We went back where you originally had the mom-and-pop stores. You walk in, they knew your name, they knew the name of your dog, they pat you on the shoulder, and you walked out, they knew you. Large corporations came in, and the mom-and-pops couldn't compete with the corporations. So the mom-and-pops disappeared. The large corporations were doing fine until they went international, they went globally. They ran into the same spot that the mom-and-pops ran into. Couldn't compete in that market. So they outsourced. And when they outsourced, those people who lost their jobs went home, got on their computer, became entrepreneurs, and now you got the mom and pop back, but this time you've got somebody that can be on a level playing field with those major businesses.
Oh, undoubtedly, and never before has the small business person been in a more powerful position because of A, globalism, and B, the distribution of information via the internet. So now we don't need to be a giant corporation to sell our products all over the world and sell our products deep into our own community in incredibly efficient ways. So it comes back to your first point about the importance of collaboration here, not just collaboration with your own employees, of course, but collaboration with your potential customers. We've come from a culture where every business just tried to sell something. Now we've moved to a culture, I believe, where the most successful businesses are actually trying to be in conversation and community with their potential customers, not just trying to sell something, but trying to help them, trying to educate them, trying to enhance their lives. And as a result of that enhanced relationship, then selling them a lot more.
I think that's one of the key ingredients for success today, Simon. You take everybody that's out there, they're trying to be competitive, so they're going to drop their price and they're going to create this and that, and they're going outside of their own realm I lost the word I wanted. At 4 o'clock in the morning, I'll remember it and I'll tell you what the word is. But their own influence, there's what I want. They're going outside of the realm of their own influence. If they would just stay inside, look from within, get their own unique selling propositions that is different from everybody else, and take care of the customers that they have. That's the success. That's one of the key elements to be able to make it through these hard times today.
Oh, undoubtedly. And most people have never done a proper inventory of their strengths and their company's strengths when they're selling a product. And there's a whole chapter in Why People Fail that I wrote on strengths and sticking to the strengths. Because once again, there's a prevalent view in society that if you've got some weaknesses, you've got to just fix your weaknesses. But all kinds of research indicates that whether it's your company or it's yourself, focusing on your strengths and enhancing those strengths is a much faster road to success rather than just concentrating on fixing weaknesses.
Now, by the way, page 77 of your book, you noticed I memorized the entire thing here. But page 77 of the book, when I die, what kind of a life would I like to have had? There's an exercise that I learned years ago that works really well to answer that question. You project yourself 10, 15 years ahead, whether it be personal, business, or whatever the case may be, and you imagine yourself at a party, and the party is in your honor. And you write down everything you want those people to say about you. And now you got 10 or 15 years to become that person that you want to be. And I think it's the same thing with business. Put it down. 15, 20 years from now, what do you want? What's the steps that you have to take to get there to achieve those goals.
Yeah, well, I love that exercise, and it really connects to, in my mind, to a brilliant piece of research done at Harvard by Dr. Edward Banfield, and he looked at what were the factors in someone in America rising up to a different economic level. And his conclusion was the number one factor was long-term time perspective. Those people that thought long-term, like you suggest, tended to have much greater likelihood of moving up the economic ladder, whereas the people who didn't make much money or get where they wanted to go economically had very short time frames. So they'd spend the money rather than save it. They'd take a job that might give them an early advantage rather than perhaps taking a job that might give them more extensive long-term advantages or opening a business that might give them long-term advantages. This long-term time perspective is one of the most critical components. And it's very sobering to ask the question that you suggest, because quite often it reveals that we're thinking so short-term that we're not creating anything great. We're just trying to survive. Now, in this economy, of course, survival is right at the fore of everyone's mind. But the trick is to concurrently think long-term. Otherwise, we're unlikely to have a great long-term.
But here's the key, Simon. When we talk about thinking long-term, you've got to be able to have something like, you know, why people fail, 16 obstacles of success, and most importantly, how you overcome them. Most people, even if they're in business, even if they're sophisticated, does not necessarily mean they know exactly what to do. So why not take the book that you've written, and in a couple, 3 hours, you know, it would be a conglomerate of what has taken you years and years and years to put together. Why not have that condensed information and then move forward with it? I think that's the power of these kind of books, especially with people who have quote unquote been there, done that, and have gone through the process. So when you really come down to it, people need to be in the very beginning led by the hand. They've got to recognize something that they weren't aware of. It's like I've learned years ago, the old adage, and it runs like this, a good teacher knows when to be a student and a good leader knows when to follow. I change hats 3 or 4 times a week. Good leaders should know when to change hats and take a look at what we call the blind spot. The blind spot is what they didn't know was there to fix the problem. All of a sudden, they realize it. They may read one page in this book that can change their entire lives and allow them to move forward and be successful 20 years from now.
Oh, yeah. And look, you and I have both met people who are profoundly successful that owe it to a book sometimes. I mean, I read a book when I was 17 called Think and Grow Rich that changed my life. And, and you know, I've had great emails from people saying that why people fail has changed their lives as well. And I think you're so right. It comes down to this learning mindset. You know, one of the chapters in the book talks about Carol Dweck's brilliant research on the power of the growth mindset and this whole attitude that it doesn't matter if you're less intelligent or more intelligent, less lucky or more lucky than someone else. All her research has shown, over a decade's research, that if we just keep growing, if we just keep learning, then we tend to do very well in any field that we want to excel in.
Oh, absolutely, no question about it. And I really believe when it comes down to it, is be able to be to open enough to listen to what other people have to say. It's like somebody now, let's go back to that person who's become the entrepreneur. They have an idea of whatever the material is, and it starts to go. Well, you've got to augment your skills. You have to hire other people. But hire people who know more than you do. That's where the key is. You've got to take ego, and you got to put it aside, and you've got to get into the realm of what's your real objective. And getting people around you that know what to do is another key to the success of any venture that someone's going to have.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Steve Jobs had a great quote. He said, A people hire A people. B people hire C people. And I think that's true. You're forgetting, as Jim Collins, the great management expert, says in all his research, the number one reason that companies turned around that he's looked at is they got the right people on the bus, and then they worked out where they wanted to go. Having the team be of high caliber, and even if you have to outsource that high caliber of team, is mission one in getting the business going.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you, we're starting to run out of time. Why people fail? What was it? What overarching theme did you hear from all of the people you've ever worked with that caused you to say, okay, we have a problem we need to fix here, which stimulated you to put the book to pen? What's that overarching theme that you have found in business after business after business that was the problem that they had to overcome?
That's a great question. And I think the answer is that when I was growing up, I would, you know, watch TV shows about people who've been successful and, you know, read magazine articles about people who've been successful. And I was under the impression that they were supermen and superwomen. And it wasn't until I read many, many business biographies and in my work met many of the richest people in the world and spent time alone with them that I got to the truth of it. And the truth is that the most successful people in the world are failing all the time. And that amazed me. And I think it shocks me that there aren't more books that come out and talk about failure. And why I wrote Why People Fail was to really pull back the curtains on success and show, hey, it's okay if you're failing all the time. Because the greatest people in every field of society are doing exactly the same thing.
Absolutely.
They fail, but they keep going.
Absolutely. A great analogy of that is, I think it was one of the last Rocky movies with Sylvester Stallone. He's talking to his son, and he looks at the kid, and he said, life will grind you down. It will. It will just tear you apart. But it's not how hard you hit. It's how hard you can get hit and get up and keep moving, and that's the essence. That's the key to success.
Oh, absolutely. And there's some brilliant research on resilience. That's just been done in the last 3 years that shows exactly that, that it's the lead component of success and indeed happiness, to be resilient when bad things happen to you. You know, it's something that needs to be emphasized because people think there's something wrong when things go badly in their life. But everybody has the bad stuff. It's just how you react to it and keep moving forward.
Sure, Simon, we're just about running out of time, but very quickly before you do, I think you'll appreciate this. In 1962, not that we'll ever tell anybody that year, okay, 1962, I went to work for Lincoln National Life Insurance in Beverly Hills on Wilshire Boulevard, and I was a very young life insurance agent, and the general agent, Norm Bluebond was his name, handed me a book the second day I was there, and it was Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. Yeah.
Well, what a beautiful book that is, huh?
Tell me. Now, by the way, your website where we can find you, what you're doing, and also the book.
Sure. They can visit me at simonreynolds.com, and that's Simon with two I's, S-I-I-M-O-N, reynolds.com, and join my business newsletter. And Why People Fail is on sale nationally as of last week.
Simon, hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time.
It's been fantastic. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
by myself. This is the end of romance. I'm gonna go my way by myself. Love is only a dance.
Tanya Marchiol with us. She's the author of Prosperity Principles, soon to be published tonight. Principles of principal reduction will solve the housing crisis and upstart the economy. She's a multifaceted businesswoman. She says there's never been a better time to create passive income through wise real estate investing. And for more than 12 years in many uncertain economic times, she's continued to help and educate consumers, executives, and athletes in business the importance of the real estate in their financial portfolios. And let's say, Tanya, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm going to have you do all my introductions. That was fabulous.
Thanks, Tanya. Hey, by the way,
thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely. You know, when we talk about the real estate market today, and obviously it is a great investment because it's cyclical. It has been, and it always will be. It'll come back. Who knows, where to forecast. I think the biggest problem today is nobody can get a loan.
Well, that is absolutely the number one problem. And so, in my opinion, I think what's going to happen is the private sector is absolutely going to step up. And you're going to see a whole lot more seller carries. You're going to see different type of financing. And it is going to come back. And it needs to come back correctly. And I think that that's one way that will jumpstart buying again. Because you're right, getting a loan is really, really difficult right now.
No, and by the way, what I'm seeing more and more ads for, they'll come through on email about, owner financing or rent to own. And
yes.
And you see more
and
more.
Really, there's a large influx of cash buyers right now across the country, whether it's foreign money, whether it's people using their IRA. There are several ways that people are investing in real estate and then can turn around and do that owner financing for a buyer that really may not be able to get financed traditionally right now.
Yeah, and there's many people out there that they don't want to sit on their homes. As a matter of fact, they can't really afford to keep them. And if they did a rent-to-own or rent the house, at least that income would come in to pay what they have. And I think real estate in and of itself has been, that's been the mainstay of this economy for I don't care how long we're talking about. You can talk corporations, you can talk businesses, but when it comes down to it, real estate has always been the common denominator.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with you on that.
Yeah. Now, how do we get it back to that? It's not an easy question.
Well, going back to what you just said, you're right. The problem is most homeowners are underwater. That is the number one problem. And whether you can make your payment or not, it doesn't matter. Your home is upside down and it's underwater. In states like Nevada, 60% of homeowners, of current homeowners, are underwater. That is insane. And you know what's happening. Your neighbor forecloses, and just because you can pay, there's nothing you can do right now. Which really brings me to what I'm super passionate about right now, and that's principal reduction. So principal reduction, in my opinion, would absolutely jumpstart that motor that we need to get this economy going again.
And now, okay, principal reduction is what? Let's define that in a way that everybody can get it.
Absolutely. So I'm going to give my personal example, okay? I bought my house 7 years ago for $610,000. I have personally sunk money into remodeling. If I went and had my home appraised right now, today, I would probably, it might be $500,000, it might be $525,000 on a good day with a really nice appraiser. So no matter what, I am at least, with my rehab, $200,000, $250,000 upside down in my house. However, I like my house. I'm not going anywhere, so I make my payments every month, right? It doesn't matter that I can make my payments. My house is still a burden in the sense that before the end of 2012, when the act of 2007, where you get your debt the difference between your short sale amount and what you owe is clear, right? That ends in 2012. So in order for me to make a wise financial decision, I need to decide whether I am selling my house before the end of 2012 and strategically defaulting, or if I'm going to stay here and take that tax hit. I'm either going to have to stay here for 20 years and let my house come back, or if I sell it in 5, I'm probably still going to be upside down, and I'm going to take a huge tax hit. So that's the number one problem. If a bank would reduce my principal to what this house is worth today, I could stay here, and I would have money to put back into the economy. So here, I want to give you some statistics because these blew my mind when I was doing the research, okay? CoreLogic put this out. As of June 2011, underwater homeowners, now that's people like myself that can make their payments and people who cannot, just in general, underwater homeowners owe $709 billion, okay? Seems like a lot, right? Do you know what the taxpayer bailed the banks out with? Do you have any idea?
No.
Do you know what we paid as taxpayers to bail the banks out?
No, I don't.
$14 trillion of taxpayers' money funded the bailouts. Okay? This is where my blood starts to boil. The banks are sitting on $1.64 trillion of reserves. That means they have money in the bank, they're making interest on that money in the bank, and the American homeowner who is losing that American dream and doesn't see how they could possibly own a home, which used to be what everybody wanted to do, can make it. If the banks took $709 billion off of their $1.64 trillion reserves that we funded for them, this is what would happen. $71 billion a year would be put back into the economy, which in turn would create 1.5 million jobs per year. And in general, for you and I, it would reduce our payments $6,500 a year.
Okay,
so
Tammy,
now,
let me hold you up. Hold on just for a second. I am right on with you. I am so on your side of the table that I squeak, okay? But how do we do that? What's the first step to getting something like that accomplished?
Well, every senator got my article because the problem is between government and the bank, we as homeowners, unfortunately, don't have a lot of say, and that is the most frustrating part. As a working real estate broker, I call the bank all the time with short sale offers, and you know they let them go to foreclosure, and it is absolutely ridiculous. So we, as the American public, need to come together to our senators, to our officials, and tell them what we need, because, you know, they're not looking at this. They're looking at it as a business decision. My biggest fight back on what I am saying right now is, well, you signed up for it, and that's it's a moral issue for people, right? In my opinion, we as just the general public don't run our lives like a business. Businesses make decisions. If it's a good decision, they make as much money from that decision as they can. If it's a bad decision, they find a way to restructure that debt, get out of that bad decision that they made financially, and make a better one. But we are taught as homeowners that we can't do that. And I'm here to tell everybody, yes, you can, and we need to come together to make this happen. Because the thing that's really going to kill the real estate market, like it's not already bad enough, and I don't know if you saw that CoreLogic came out and said that NAR, the National Association of Realtors, overestimated home sales by as much as 20%. That means that we actually have more homes that need to sell, and this is a bigger debacle than they wanted to admit. So we need to come together to our senators, to everyone that we possibly can, to our banks, and really push for this principal reduction because it would give us all money to put back into the economy. And that's what we need, to create jobs, to do more of what was happening when the real estate market was good. Real estate really affects everything.
Now, if I was you, this is exactly what I would do. I would take this presentation to one of the Republican candidates to let them run with it, because the exposure would be absolutely tremendous. If one of them gets to see the value of what it is that you have to say and the way that you have to say it, they're going to jump on it, because that in and of itself will be something that will help the economic condition of this country right now. So I think that's a great place for you to start. Make sure that one of them get it and jump on it.
I absolutely am going to do that. I appreciate that. And honestly, I didn't even think about it. And I am going to work diligently to make that happen.
Yeah, because
that is huge.
Yeah, no, you need exposure to this. And that's one of the greatest ways to get exposure, because what you've come up with is really a tremendous solution to one of the problems that we have. But we talk economy, we talk jobs, we talk the housing market. I mean, this goes on and on. There is a fix sitting right underneath us that we're not looking at, and this happens to be it.
I agree. 100% agree.
Yeah, no question about it. Okay, let me ask you this. We're running really short of time.
Sure.
Do you have a website that we can find you at and also get the book and get more information?
You bet. Anyone can find me at Team Investments with an S, Inc. So Team Investments, Inc. Or I'll give you my personal Twitter, which I am on all the time, and I'm always posting things. It's Mark Yo, like my last name, but it's phonetic. So it's M-A-R-K with 5 E's and an O. You can catch me there anytime, or just go to my website. You can shoot me an email, anything.
Wonder, and by the way, I will never mispronounce your last name again. It's Markio. I got it.
You got it.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great night and happy holidays.
Okay, you too. Merry Christmas. Good night.
Merry Christmas.
The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't anymore. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do.
Oh, by the way, what I don't want to miss, that at 9 o'clock is the very last